Liquid Books, Budapest's weekly English language cultural magazine.
Welcome to another episode of Liquid Books. We're joined today in the studio by a very special guest, Adam Labor. You have written a book which is spectacular. It's City of Oranges. It takes place in the city of Jaffa, and it is a history of Jaffa in the 20th century. Let me just tell our listeners a little bit about you, if I may. You were born in London, and you've read Arabic, International History and Politics, and you've worked for several British newspapers and worked as a foreign correspondent. You've covered the wars in the Balkans, and you have written a previous volume, biography of Milosevic. Now you've written this book, City of Oranges. Tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, I wanted to write a book that told the human story of Israel and Palestine, because, as you know, there's libraries are full of books about the politics and the diplomacy and the wars and everything, but no one really told the human story from both sides. So my idea was to take six families, all in one place, three Jewish families and three Arab families, and relate their lives and use their lives as a means of illustrating what happened to the people of Israel and the people of Palestine, to take the story back to those whose lives are shaped and affected by these tumultuous events, and bring the human focus to the fore.
Tell us a little more about the structure of the book.
Well, it starts in 1920 with the wedding of a young woman called Julia Shalush, who's from a very established Jewish family in Jaffa that arrived about 100 years before that from North Africa. And from that, it goes on to the riots in 1921 between the Jews and Arabs. And it shows that this is a sort of the mix that I was hoping to get. There's an interplay between her wedding and the preparations for the wedding, and then the riots and the violence that erupts. And I try and all the time bring the story, the main story, back to the families and use them as a means to illustrate what was going on. Because what was fascinating about Julia's wedding was that the British High Commissioner for Palestine, after the riots, tried to use her wedding as a means to bring Jews and Arabs together, and asked her father to invite Arab notables and Arab community leaders to the wedding. And indeed they did come.
There's an implicit but, or and.
Yes, well, that's well spotted. Yeah, there is an implicit but. They did come, and they said to the father, you know, Mr. Shalush, this is the first time we've come into Tel Aviv since the riots, but the fact that they came to the wedding didn't really alter the trajectory of history, as we know. So
the incident you're describing is one of many in this book. It is a very warm and engaging narrative. It reads like one of the grand narratives of history, but it is so personal. It's so filled with individual details, sensual details, details of the light, the sounds, the weather. It's really an accomplished and incredibly pleasing work, and it gives such an immediateness to such a colorful history in very humane, very day-to-day terms. May I ask you perhaps to read an excerpt?
Yes, I will. And thank you very much for your compliments. It's nice to be so praised. Let me start with the first page, page one, which is always a good place to start. And this is the beginning of the book. In Jaffa, in the spring of 1921, a young Jewish woman called Julia Bochbut was planning her wedding. Julia was 21, dark-haired and vivacious, with lively eyes. She was a popular girl who made friends easily. She was fluent in Arabic and French, played the piano, and was gifted at needlework. Julia danced the waltz and even the daring new import from South America, the tango. The Bochbut family lived on Nagib Bustros Street, the heart of Jaffa's commercial centre that drew shoppers from across the Levant. The shop windows displayed the latest European fashions and household goods, while neighbouring cafes were crowded with customers drinking coffee, smoking and eating ice cream. Spacious Italianate apartments were built above the shops and overlooked the street. The flats had stone floors, high ceilings to let the sea breeze flow through, arched windows and long balconies decorated with fine ironwork. Julia had just returned from a 2-month trip to Cairo to see her relatives and prepare her trousseau. Her fiancé was a man called David Shalouch, who was considered quite a catch. David was 10 years older, tall and pleasant-looking with dark eyes, but good looks were secondary to the fact that the Shalouch family was one of the most respected dynasties in Jaffa, if not in all Palestine. The Shalouches were leaders of Jaffa's Jewish community, and they also helped found neighbouring Tel Aviv. Like the Bochbutz, they were Sephardim from North Africa, Jews who could trace their ancestry back to the expulsion from Spain in 1492, known in Hebrew as Sepharad. At home, the Shalouches and the Bochbutz usually spoke Arabic, not Hebrew. Jaffa's Sephardic families were linked together by marriage, blood and business. David's uncles owned a thriving shop on Nagib Bustros Street that sold building materials and beautifully patterned tiles. The Shalouch brothers' pipes, bricks and ironwork were designed for modern European-style homes, but the brightly coloured symmetrical patterns on the tiles were rooted in the Orient. Jaffa's profitable commercial life was testimony to the web of social and business links that still bound together Arab and Jew.
Thus begins this spectacular narrative, which delves into the heart of the old city and presents a half dozen or so families and their intertwining lives as they develop over what for me was a very surprising history of the city. The history as you tell it, or as these families tell it, is not, for whatever reason, the history that I knew. What explains this incredible richness of history that is edited out of our usual picture?
Well, I think traditionally, or in many cases, that Jaffa's sort of been slightly airbrushed out of history. It's now a fairly dilapidated suburb of Tel Aviv, but people don't realise that it's got its own magnificent history of a 3,000-year-old port, and it was through Jaffa that most Jewish immigrants arrived, you know, until at least after the Second World War, because Jaffa was the main port of Palestine. So it's always been the entry for Jewish immigration as well. But the story of the relationship between Jaffa and Tel Aviv is particularly fascinating, because Tel Aviv, which I didn't really realise this myself, originally started as a very small satellite of Jaffa, that as more Jewish immigrants came in the late 19th century, they needed places to stay. So the Shalouch family and other families of the Jewish community of Jaffa bought some land outside Tel Aviv and built a new quarter called Neve Tzedek, which was like a Jewish quarter of Jaffa. And it's important to realise at this time that all Ottoman cities, and Jaffa was part of the empire, were divided into quarters. So you'd have in Jaffa or in Jerusalem or in Damascus, you know, there would be the Jewish quarter, the Armenian quarter, the Greek quarter, maybe the Italian quarter, for all the different minorities that lived in the cities. So it wasn't a particularly political thing to do as such, just to buy some land and build more houses for the Jewish immigrants. But somehow, inexorably, because of the historical forces that were at play, that it became a political act and led to the foundation of Tel Aviv, which was a very political city, obviously, because it was the capital of the Yishuv, the Zionist settlement. And Tel Aviv itself was deliberately built as a kind of antithesis of Jaffa, with very modern European houses, very regulated. The gardens had specific regulations for the size of the fence and the way that the roofs were built. Everything was controlled.
What you describe is really one of the most outstanding features of the book, the fact that things are not in themselves political acts, but in effect become political acts, become politicized. And that's, I think, one of the great values of this book, that it goes under that and tells the stories simply. You keep coming back to the idea that although there were tensions, even outbreaks of violence throughout the whole period, surprisingly, coexisting with that was also cooperation, business, intermarriage, even a great deal of day-to-day calm and peaceful interaction, so that things are not necessarily identical to their categories.
Well, I think, what you said before, in a way, there's a kind of lost history that during the period of the Mandate from 1918 to 1948, although tension steadily did increase, and by the end of the 40s, the violence was horrendous, there was also cooperation, that Jews and Arabs did do business together, that young Arab guys would leave Jaffa and go to Tel Aviv for a night out, that Jews from Tel Aviv came to Jaffa to do their shopping. One of the families in the book is called the Hamamis, who left in 1948, and the head of the family, Ahmad Hamami, worked in the citrus business, and his children told me that he had many Jewish partners, you know, and they would do business, they would swap leases on the orange groves and the lemon groves. If he had one that was more convenient for a Jewish organization or a Jewish business, they would swap. So there was cooperation, and you know, perhaps there may have been a way to have resolved this without exploding into violence. There may not have been, but I think it's also worth exploring this narrative which somehow has disappeared.
We will come back to the book in a second. I understand you've also brought in some music from your personal collection to share with us. What are we going to listen to?
Well, the first song I brought in is from an album called Sahara Blue, which is directed by Hector Zazu. And I want to play a song called Am Diaz, which I really like. And the first time I heard it, it gave me amazing goose pimples, because it fits in with the themes of the book. It mixes the Algerian singer Khaled singing in Arabic with an Israeli singer called Malka Spiegel singing in Hebrew. And as you hear their voices kind of merging and fading in and out of each other to the background, it's sort of a message that maybe through culture, maybe we should put politics aside, focus on culture. That may be a way for the peoples to live together and at least get to know each other better.
משחררת את כל הצלילים ומתחילה ההרמוניה החדשה חדשים וצעידתם קדימה חושך סוטה אהבה חדשה חושך נוטה אהבה חדשה
מעריף כרישון אל אחיין אצלן
شبيه נקריא את גורלנו, נפיא את המגפות, והתחילי עם הזמן. שרים לך הילדים האלה, הקימי אי בזה את ההוויה של מזלותינו, של משלתנו, מתחננים אליי.
We're back talking with Adam Labor, author of his latest book, City of Oranges, a narrative of Arabs and Jews in Jaffa in the 20th century. Adam, what motivated you to undertake the writing of this book?
Well, it was partly rooted in my own upbringing. I had a traditional Jewish childhood, went to two Jewish schools in London, and I went on a kibbutz before I went to university when I was 18 for 6 months. And then I started diverging slightly from the usual path. I decided to study Arabic at university, because when I was on the kibbutz, I always remember that there was a lot of Israeli Arab workers that would come in for the day, and they were slightly apart from the Jewish Israelis that lived on the kibbutz. And the relations were fine, but you could see that there was something obviously slightly different about them. And I became intrigued as to existence of this substantial minority within Israel, and wanted to learn more about it, because again, that's a kind of story that we don't hear that much about. It's slightly been written out of history. So I decided to learn Arabic, and at university I began to meet Palestinians for the first time, and hear about, you know, what had happened to them, and the Palestinian view of what had happened in 1948, which was very different to what I had been taught. And you know, I realized after a while that obviously both sides were essentially propagandist, and the truth was somewhere in the middle, as it usually is in these cases. So I'd always had an interest in Palestine and Israel. You know, I'd been there many times, and I also studied at Hebrew University, colloquial Palestinian Arabic. But I think what really was the motive for this book was the time that I spent as a journalist in the Balkans covering the Bosnian and the Croatian wars. And I saw what happened to the Bosnian Muslims there. Now, let me be very clear, this wasn't the same as what happened to the Palestinians. It was far, far worse. I mean, I believe the Palestinians' exodus was a dispersal. Some people were thrown out, some people ran away. We'll never really know what the true proportions were. But I could see that the Palestinians said they had been ethnically cleansed like the Bosnian Muslims. And I wanted to investigate that and see how true that was, and have a look at that story. But I didn't want to do another kind of big historical document-based fact, you know, looking in the archives as to what military operation had caused which village to population to flee, because that's already been done by Israeli historians. Now, as to go back to what I said before, I wanted to tell the human story. So I thought that the best way to do that would be to focus on half a dozen families, three Jewish and three Arab, but root it in a place, because then you have a much stronger focus for the book, because you can have the place, the story of the place itself, and tell what's happening to the place. And that also illustrates what's happening to the wider story. And so the place I chose was Jaffa.
It must have immensely enriched your appreciation of the place to have that chance to talk with long-time residents and to get to know the city from their perspective.
Oh yes, it was an amazing experience, because previously when I'd been to Jaffa, I'd just been to the old city, which has been prettified and restored, and, you know, thank God it hasn't been demolished, but it's it's got this slightly unreal air about it because it's full of art galleries and restaurants and little jewellery shops, but really it was the heart of an ancient Arab port that had been around for 3,000 years, and you can't really tell that much anymore. But I thought all of Jaffa was like that, but I had no idea there was this vast hinterland or all sorts of suburbs called Ajami and Jabalia and the areas around Jaffa to the north of Jaffa, Manshia, which bordered with Tel Aviv, and everything was symbolic and everything meant something. For example, if you go to Tel Aviv now, you can see a mosque by the Sheraton Hotel, which is called the Hassan Bek Mosque. Now, that mosque was deliberately put there in the start of the 20th century by the governor of Jaffa as a means of stopping Tel Aviv moving south into Jaffa. It's like the northernmost outpost of Jaffa. And ever since it's been built, even right up to the present day, there's been riots and fighting around that mosque. Whenever the tension erupts, it's always around that mosque, even just a couple of years ago. So you see this sort of strange mosque next to a five-star hotel and you have no idea why it's there. And then you start to unpeel the reason why it's there and what it symbolizes. And it's absolutely fascinating.
In your book, you give a lovely account of how in the early days people would come to the seaside there, and it was a chance also for Arabs to enjoy a little bit of Jewish culture. So it was a real meeting point.
Yes, it was a meeting point. The seafront in that suburb of Jaffa, which no longer exists, called Manshia, it was an absolute meeting point. Jews lived there, Arabs lived there, the headquarters of the Jewish communists were there, and Arab notables lived there. Also poor Jewish immigrants. It was a complete melting pot, a real Mediterranean, Middle Eastern city. And it's all completely gone now. It's just turned into a park. And you'd never know it was even there.
As the narrative unfolds, although you do focus on the human elements, we do get a growing sense of how these conflicts developed and how they spilled over into violence and into separation and into destruction in some cases. You do also several times show us how parts of the history of the city is lost in this process, disappeared or gone forever. Sometimes, for example, the old quarter of Jaffa you describe as having been totally lost and degraded and then finally reconstituted.
Yeah, it's been, as I said, it's been reconstituted as an artist quarter. But what's interesting is that one of the people in my book is a man called Frank Meisler, who left Danzig as it was in 1939, came to Britain, came to live in Israel in the 1950s. He's one of the country's most famous artists now. And he has a big studio and a foundry in old Jaffa. But he's a very intelligent man, and he told me that sometimes being in Jaffa reminds him of when he goes back to visit Danzig, which part of which has been reconstructed, but most of which was destroyed. And he said, the people there are squatters, and in a sense we're squatters here now, because it's, you know, the original inhabitants are all gone. I mean, they've 95,000 people ran away or were expelled, depending on your perspective of interpretation of what happened in 1948. But on the other hand, that's the reality of life in any city. I mean, if you look at any city, you know, waves of people come and waves of people go, new people come in, they demolish and they build, and they demolish and they build, and that's what happens in cities. So it's part of history. I mean, it's not like Jaffa is unique in that sense.
Perhaps not, but you also give a moving account of some hundreds of Palestinian villages in the countryside, which were, your word is, disappeared.
Yes, they were disappeared. After 1948 and the Palestinian exodus, a new map of Israel was drawn up, and a lot of these villages were demolished, or they were just allowed to stand for a while, and then they were eventually demolished, and bits of them were incorporated into Jewish, or rather Israeli villages and towns, or kibbutzes. And it's as though they had to be destroyed and wiped off the map in order, because otherwise they were a permanent reminder of what had been there before.
We also see the people themselves change over the course of these years. So this is a chronological narrative in which we see people starting out in their youth with their family background, with great hopes and aspirations, and then how circumstances degrade those aspirations or pervert their intentions in other ways.
Yes, I mean, one of the main characters in the book is a man called Hassan Hamami, And he left Jaffa in 1948 on a boat with his family when he was about 16, and he had expected to spend his life probably in Palestine, go to university, get a good job, marry and settle down. And then the family was thrown into exile, and he lived in Lebanon and Syria and Saudi Arabia, eventually met a British woman at university in Nottingham in Britain and married her, and now lives in Florida. And he talks very movingly about how, you know, he's enjoyed success, financial success. They have a beautiful house, they have a yacht, he has three lovely daughters who've all got families of their own. But something is missing from his life, and always will be, that he's in exile, he's in the diaspora, and nothing can compensate for that.
Did you find that these people were eager to talk to you and share their stories?
Oh, very much so. I mean, the book wouldn't have worked if they didn't want to talk to me. There was one or two people that didn't want to talk to me, but if they didn't want to talk to me, I didn't put them in the book. I mean, especially once I'd met them once or twice, then they really started to open up. But yeah, the book works because people trusted me and told me their stories. And I would add that I took a lot of efforts to make sure that they were happy with what I was writing. I checked all their quotes back with them so they know what was going to appear in print, which you know, you normally do in a straight journalistic enterprise. But I was very aware that I was writing about people's lives. You know, this is real people's fathers and mothers and sisters and brothers, and I wanted them to be happy. And one of the great things which I've been very pleased about is that as they've started to read the book, several of the families, both Jewish and Arab, have written to me saying how much they like it, which I think it's at least there's one thing in the world that they can agree on.
That's wonderful. The key turning point, I suppose, in the history of Palestine is the foundation of the Jewish state in 1948. And again, there, you present it to us not in terms of the political declarations and so on, but in terms of the day-to-day transformations of people's lives and their ideologies.
Yes, one of the interesting characters in the book on the Jewish side is a man called Yoram Aharoni, who left Bulgaria in 1941 and came to Palestine. And he was immediately arrested by the British authorities because Britain was at war with Bulgaria. He was arrested as an enemy alien. And as soon as he was released, I think a couple of years later, he joined the Stern Group, or the Stern Gang as they were known. And they were the most extreme of the three Zionist militias. There was a Haganah, which was the main one, Menachem Begin's Irgun, and the Stern Gang. And he told me that they considered every British official, every soldier, every policeman, although not their families, not women and children, as legitimate targets. And he had no compunction about that, and he had no regret about it now. But he said it was very strange for him, and he was in Stern Gang together with his wife, Rina, in 1948, when Israel became a state. Suddenly the Stern Group was absorbed into the Israeli army, and now, who basically had been a kind of guerrilla terrorist organisation operating on a cell-like structure, had to start taking orders and be absorbed into this big military machine, which they weren't used to at all. I mean, these little flashes of insight that I'd never thought about before, but I think helped bring the narrative alive.
In your work, one senses the extraordinary compassion and authenticity of the events you're describing. The picture you portray, that despite what the Balfour Declaration or the British government was negotiating, the reality on the ground was what mattered, and there was a great scramble to define the borders of the Israeli state.
Yes, that's what happened in 1948. I mean, people forget that Israel was created by a United Nations resolution. No, it was created under international law in November 1947. But as soon as the partition, which would have partitioned Palestine into Jewish and Arab states, but as soon as that resolution was passed, fighting immediately broke out. Because it's one thing, it's very nice for the UN to pass a resolution with these borders, but what matters is who has the men on the ground with the guns to control the territory. So fighting immediately broke out. And there was a lot of fighting between Jaffa and Tel Aviv, because that was the fault line between the Yishuv and the Palestinians. So there was sniping, there were bomb attacks, there was fighting, low-level fighting all the time.
And as you describe it, it was also the impetus for these disparate Israeli gangs to come together and form a united front.
Yes, yeah. Although there were always divisions. It's interesting that what happened in April 1948 in Jaffa was that the Haganah, the main Jewish militia, didn't want to capture Jaffa, they just wanted to blockade it. And then leave it, because Jaffa was given to the Palestinians under the partition plan. So they didn't really want to attack it because they knew that Britain and the international community would be very angry. But Menachem Begin's Irgun, the right-wing militia, did want to attack it because they believed that it would be a base from within the Jewish state to attack everything else. So they believed it had to be captured. And eventually Begin's Irgun launched this ferocious three-day mortar bombardment on Jaffa, which is when the Hamami family fled.
Let's take a short musical break and we'll continue. Welcome back. We're talking with Adam Labor. Adam, what music have we just been listening to?
We've been listening to a song called Haiduk by a French artist called Didier Malherbe. And I just thought that as we're in Budapest, we should have something with a slight Hungarian flavour. And Haiduk is Hungarian for bandits or kind of outlaws. And it's just a great piece of music.
Yes, it is. Why don't we ask you to read another excerpt from City of Oranges?
Gladly. I'd like to read a short piece, jumping forward to the middle of the book. I try to build up the narrative so that the climax of the book is in 1948. And then we see what happens to all the families. And one of the main Palestinian families, the Hammam, is they flee. As we've mentioned, as we spoke before, the Erdogan launched a 3-day mortar bombardment on Jaffa. And Ahmed Hammami was caught downtown when the shells started falling, and his daughter Fadwa and his son described to me how he ran straight home and packed up the family and put them on a boat to Lebanon. And they talked about, very movingly, about their exodus, and they talked about what it was like at the port, the scenes of chaos with the small boats taking the refugees out to the big boats moored out to sea, coming backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And the terrible journey itself. So, let's start. By the second day at sea, Mustafa Hammami no longer thought that the journey was a great adventure. There was barely any food, little water, and most of what he ate came straight back up again. We were seasick. We vomited into a drainage pipe. I'd never before smelled that acrid stench of vomit and urine, and I still remember it now. That night, the boat ran into a storm. It was dangerously overloaded and began to list to one side. Several millennia before, the prophet Jonah had fled Jaffa on a cargo ship. Jonah was trying to escape God's command to go and preach at Nineveh. Jonah's boat hit bad weather. The Bible records, "Then the Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. All the sailors were afraid, and each cried out to his own God. And they threw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship. The Hammami's captain also ordered the passengers to throw all heavy belongings overboard." Mustafa recalled, "We were all frightened. The next morning one woman could not find her newborn baby. In the darkness and confusion, she must have accidentally thrown it overboard. Her wailing broke our hearts. That night, an old man passed away and a woman delivered a baby. We were very shocked, and a somber mood fell on us. We sat quietly for the rest of the voyage," says Mustafa. "A Royal Navy vessel passed by, and a sailor barked into his loud hailer. Who were they, and where were they going, and what were they doing? We are Arabs, leaving Jaffa, and heading for Beirut," someone shouted. The ship sailed closer. The crew swept the spotlight up and down the rows of shivering, frightened refugees before pulling away. "I often wonder what went through that captain's mind when he saw us packed like sardines and then steamed away without offering us any help," says Hassan Hammami, Mustafa's older brother. "On the last morning, a Lebanese fighter flew overhead. So low, Mustafa could see its markings. The journey by boat from Jaffa to Beirut normally took 12 hours. After 3 days at sea, the Hammamis disembarked at the southern Lebanese port of Tyre. Ahmed Hammami, the family patriarch, father of Mustafa and Hassan, never saw Jaffa or his house again. His wife Nafis and several of their children would return decades later. By then, Ahmed's house would have new owners and Jaffa new rulers."
Adam, the researching and writing of this book must have given you a tremendous opportunity for insight into the roots of the conflict between Israel and Palestine. What have you learned from this experience?
What I've learned is I've come to a slightly unorthodox conclusion, which is that I think it's time that Israel considered abolishing the law of return, which gives Jews automatic citizenship, and removing all the restrictions on the Arab minority within Israel, which they are full citizens in a democracy, but there are still restrictions, some small restrictions on them owning land and being able to buy land from the state. And I argue that all this should be abolished, and that Israel should focus on becoming an Israel of all its citizens, in the sense that Israeli nationality should be based on more normal criteria of statehood, which is, for example, shared Hebrew culture, shared economy, shared language, living in a common contiguous space. And then when Israel decides what kind of state it is, it will be in a much better position to make peace with the Palestinians.
And what's your assessment of the possibilities for any of those developments?
Well, there is this was a kind of fringe left-wing idea, the idea of Israel as a state of all its citizens, but it's moved into the mainstream. Now, I should emphasize that it's not the same as another idea which is also floating around, which is Israel as a binational state. That argues that Israel and the West Bank should become one country. Now, I don't believe that at all, because I think Israel is a state that exists and has a right to exist, and its people have a right to exist as Israelis, just as the Palestinians have a right to a viable, proper, contiguous state on the land that was captured in 1967. I think peoples need to go through statehood before they can talk about giving it up. I think at the moment the outlook is very bleak. The election of Hamas is very bad news for the prospects of peace. It's bad news because it represents the growing influence of radical Islam. I mean, Hamas is an organization that's dispatched numerous suicide bombers into Israel. It refuses to recognize Israel. So Hamas and Likud and the Israeli right in that sense feed off each other, because the Israeli right can say, look, there's no one for us to talk to, and Hamas can say, we don't want to talk to you anyway. So they're kind of locked in this kind of dance macabre, and they each time one takes a step, they lead the other. And I think it's going to be very difficult to break that logjam. I mean, although I've focused on the story of the people here, I'm not any kind of starry-eyed idealist. And the other factor here is that Hamas is essentially a theological organization. Now, Israel and Arafat and the PLO, although the negotiations weren't very successful in many ways, they were at least taking place, and boundaries and borders and the number of Palestinians allowed to come back under any final settlement, all these things can be negotiated because you're talking about real concrete things. But it's very hard to negotiate with people who say they have a divine mandate rather than a purely electoral one.
Is there any concrete experience of working on this book which has led you to such conclusions?
Which conclusion?
Your recommendations for a sensible way forward for Israel.
Well, I think that if you look at the history, as I did in great detail for 100 years, you see that obviously in 1948 it was a good idea to pass a law of return after the Holocaust. And with the exodus of the Arab Jewish communities, many of whom were also expelled, which is a part of the story that's often forgotten as well, that there needed to be a place where Jews could come, get refuge, and get immediate citizenship in their own country. And that was right in 1948. But it's now almost 60 years after that. The world has moved on. And most Jews who want to go and live in Israel are perfectly free to go and do that. So, although not all, I understand there's still some Jews within Arab communities. But I think that you have to look at statehood as a dynamic process, and it has to evolve in response to the world. We're not living in a world still dealing with the immediate aftermath of the Holocaust. You know, Israel is a very strong power. It has a strong economy. It has a very strong army. And it also has a substantial Arab minority. Now, this idea is not... although it started out as a left-wing fringe idea, I mean, Shin Bet themselves, Israeli domestic security service, have argued you must give the Arab minority in Israel full, 100% full civil equality, and then you demand full civic loyalty. But you make an Israel that they can be part of as well, so that they don't always feel outsiders as Arabs in a Jewish state.
Do you think there's widespread popular resistance to that idea in Israel, or it's simply a question of time at this point?
Well, I think, yeah, there is widespread popular resistance to this idea, but it's kind of, I think, in a way, without sounding too self-important, it's a sort of a writer's job to push ideas out into the mainstream and see what happens to them. You know, I mean, part of me, as someone Jewish, thinks, well, maybe we shouldn't do that. I mean, maybe it's too early, or maybe it's not right, but I think it has to be discussed. And one thing is clear, that the nature of the state needs to evolve, because it's not 1948 anymore.
This kind of framing of the conflict also is so archetypal. It resonates in so many different parts of the world. There is a period of time when a compensation is necessary, either direct compensation to people who have suffered or legal compensation to give people greater opportunity than what they had before. And then there's a generation or two of healing which occurs, of rebalancing, and after that there's a time to reconsider what is the most sensible step forward.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the pattern between Israel and Palestine has been examined and is examined every day much more than most conflicts in the world, but it's not a particularly unique pattern. I mean, one of the people in my book was a man called Ibrahim Abu Lughod, who was a Palestinian political scientist, and he kind of cut through everything. He said, look, conflicts, national conflicts in one small area of territory produce refugees. I mean, you can talk about whether the Palestinians were expelled or how many ran away and what the proportions were, but the fact is, refugees, wars produce refugees. Now the question is, what happens to those refugees?
Your book has already been published. It's published by
Bloomsbury,
yes. Have you had any reader reaction?
Yes, I have. I've had some very interesting reader reactions. I gave a talk at Jewish Book Week, which is a literary festival in Britain, and the mother of a friend of mine came up to me after I gave my talk, and she said, oh, Adam, I'm so annoyed with you. And I said, why? What's the matter? And she said, well, everything was so clear before I'd read your book. You know, I knew that the Arabs were essentially in the wrong and we, the Jews, were in the right. But now I've read your book and everything's turned upside down and I don't know what to think anymore. And she was laughing, but I could see that I'd done something quite good here, in the sense that her preconceptions had been shaken up and she'd been given a new perspective. And I thought that if I can do that, I can make Jews and Israelis see the Palestinians as human beings, and the Palestinians, just as importantly, to see the Israelis as human beings, not just soldiers in tanks or pilots of fighter planes, then maybe I can achieve something here.
In parallel to that, you give us quite a realistic description of a very difficult period that we're living through in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Nonetheless, the sheer fact of your taking the effort to write this book and to write it so beautifully, I find a testament of hope, and I hope that our listeners are able to find this message in your book.
Thank you very much. That's really the reason why I wrote it.
I understand you've brought another piece for us to listen to. What is this last piece of music?
This song is called Hope. It's by it's a collaboration between a Bangladeshi British artist called Nitin Sawhney and a singer called Natasha Atlas, who is herself half Jewish and half Arab. And again, like the first song we listened to, Am Diaz, it kind of mixes Hebrew and Asian influences together. And I think, the song is called Hope, and I think we have to have hope.
Thank you for coming and talking with us. We hope you will join us again sometime. And thank you to our engineer, Naji, and from all of us here at Liquid Books, we wish you a good night. Thank you.
Thank you.